It's the Full 48. Howard Beck, senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report. Seeding games are over. The glorified exhibition season, as I've called it, done. Historic first ever NBA play-in game is tomorrow. I'm recording this on on Friday morning. Play-in game tomorrow, Saturday. And if the Blazers win, it's all over. And if the Grizzlies win, they play again Sunday. I think I have that right. And then playoffs starting Monday. Day games on weekdays. Many of them. Strap in, folks. A lot to cover about what we've just seen and what's to come. Pleasure to bring back good friend, Bleacher Report contributor, Mo Dakhil. How are you, sir?
I'm doing well, man. Basketball's been back, so I'm back. I'm feeling pretty good.
Yeah, and I think we're all happy to have something to talk about here, and we've got plenty from the last couple weeks. Should also note, of course, you are also a podcaster with The Athletic, former video coordinator for the Spurs and Clippers, and you have a story that popped on Bleacher Report this morning about some trends and revelations in the bubble, which we'll get to later. But Mo, I wanted to start with the historic, first ever, unprecedented, ultimately intriguing play-in game. And not because the play-in game itself is going to be so great necessarily. It's not about Portland versus Memphis, right? Like, that'll be fun, it'll be fine, and it's a game, and it's new, and it's different. What's great about it, and what I think is important now, having seen the last couple weeks, the NBA just proved why the play-in game, which they've been flirting with, proposing, shelving, but never adopting, we just saw why it's great. Yesterday, which was the second to last day of this weird extended regular season, we still had four teams fighting for the eighth spot, or at least fighting for a chance to play for the play-in game for the eighth spot. So four teams, at least two of whom, maybe three of whom, would have in a normal season been just, mailing it in, were motivated to play and to win. And two other teams were just eliminated within the last couple of days. That was the Kings and New Orleans. So basically the entire conference, minus the two teams that weren't invited, Minnesota and Golden State, that in a normal season, Mo, would be a really great outcome if late March and early April games were involving 13 of the 15 teams still had something to play for. I don't see any downside to continuing this.
So I'm a little bit of a wet blanket on it to a degree.
All right, wet blanket away.
So for me, my first thing is I feel like this kind of further devalues the regular season. And look, these guys played 82 games, and I joke with friends when they talk about it. I go like, yeah, they have an 82 game play-in tournament. Like, that's what this is, And would we be any less excited if, Portland, if there was no play-in game, Portland still would have clinched the eighth seed with a phenomenal game last night. Yes. And that would have been it. And then we would have been starting the playoffs this weekend. So it's not, I don't know how much. I get the intrigue and it involves more teams and keeps more teams engaged. But I think that's also part of this is the bubble and effect to a degree. I don't know in a normal setting if it's going to be as exciting. This is a weird circumstance. So I'm all good with let's do the play-in game. Let's have this kind of free-for-all kind of situation. But in 82-game season, I just don't know if we're really going to see it kind of come out this way and be as close as it was in this scenario.
So it's funny. I love that you're throwing the wet blanket on it because you are coming from the perspective of somebody who worked for NBA teams for many years. And the pushback that I've heard has been from people like Kendrick Perkins yesterday on The Jump. I think, did somebody quote Brett Brown earlier this season saying something like what you said? We have a regular season to sort this out. And so it's funny. So if you are one of the competitors, a coach, a player, scout, whatever, it's all about, listen, we already did this. We don't water down all of our accomplishments of November through mid-April. But I'm looking at it from a different perspective here. For the sake of the fans of those teams, for the sake of the those markets, the ratings, the relevance of those games down the stretch, for TV purposes, for the TV partners, and even from a league perspective, I don't think there is a better anti-tanking measure. They redid the lottery odds. It's still too soon to know if the rejiggered odds have had any effect on tanking. I don't think they have, frankly, but it's early. We need a good 5 to 6 years at least before we know if that had an impact on the way teams operate down the stretch if they were a team that was out of the running for a playoff spot. But this is the best anti-tanking measure there could be, Mo. A bunch of teams that in ordinary years we would have been like, the Suns, they're dead in the water. The Spurs, you know, wow, the streak is going to finally end. We would have been writing off some of these teams, and they would have been writing it off those games. They would have been pulling the plug, resting their guys, playing the G League guys. Oh, we're experimenting. We're giving the guys some experience. And there's some validity to that, right? It's a very murky middle area between tanking, throwing away regular season games toward the end versus developing the youth. It's hard to tell sometimes. But if this is any indication, those teams could play meaningful games. And so it's not about, I'm not trying to take away from what the possible eighth seed already accomplished and what those other teams didn't accomplish. But it also gives, by the way, some wiggle room for if you started off the season with some terrible injuries, as the Blazers did.
Right.
Now, granted, in a normal year, they're not getting Nurkic and Collins back. But there are instances like that in a normal regular season. You get guys back, and now you're who you should have been. And I don't know. To me, it works. Now, the format the league has thrown around was more of a 7 through 10 mini tournament for play-in. And it would be 7 would play 8, and the winner becomes the 7th seed. The loser becomes the 8th seed. 9 plays 10. The loser's out, and the team that won the 9 versus 10 plays the winner of, or the plays the loser of 7 versus 8, so plays the 8th seed, and then that's possibly to get in. Now, if you're a 7th seeded team at the end of the regular season and you lose the play-in game to the 8th seed, and now you're 8, and then you play the winner of 9-10, and you lose that game, and suddenly you're out, and you've gone from 7 to out, you're going to be pretty pissed off, I suppose.
Yeah, and if you're Dallas, but if you're Dallas, for example, in that scenario, you know, Dallas was pretty far ahead from the 8th seed, you know,
sure.
Once this bubble started. Like, it would suck for them to have to all of a sudden get pulled into this tournament when they did the work.
Yeah.
You know, and I 100% get it with the fans and the media stuff, and it's exciting, you know, and this is actually something I've said about the Elam ending, too, in the sense of, you know, everybody clamors for it. We had one good All-Star game. We don't know if it works. Like, you know, we're getting a little ahead of ourselves sometimes, you know. And I don't mind if we experiment with this and maybe we play with it here. And it's almost like a political race where it's too close to call. So we're going to have a play-in game or something like that. I don't know if there's a way to set that up. But I just feel like, especially the way it's set up, 7 through 10, I think it's pretty unfair to, you know, the 8 seed that's done the work. And, you know, the 7th seed that's, you know, done even more work in that scenario. So there's a lot of things that play into it because you're right. The Blazers getting healthy, you know, played a big role. But I also feel bad for Memphis. They played well all season, you know, and you know, outperformed their skill level, I think. And you know, kind of they definitely exceeded expectations. And now they're in a play-in game and they nearly were packing up and going home. So it's tough.
All right, but let me push back on a level that I think should appeal to your mentality as a you know, into NBA insider type who worked for teams and who wants to value the regular season and all this other stuff. Because the other thing that teams will often say is, look, let's reward the teams, or not necessarily reward the teams. We want to value what teams are doing at the end more than the beginning sometimes, right? Like, peaking at the right time is important. The Grizzlies got there on the momentum of you know, obviously some games in whatever, January, February, March. The Blazers are the team that are actually the higher quality team right now. And in a 7 through 10 tournament, if they were to adopt that going forward, what it would do, Mo, I feel like, is if the 7th seed or 8th seed, if one of these teams that was a little bit higher and now all of a sudden is having the regular season devalued, if it's because they built up a big advantage early on, maybe even because of schedule, but slipped toward the end, or maybe had injuries toward the end. And yeah, you don't want to punish a team for injuries, but you know what? If you're the NBA, you also want the teams that are playing the best in April to actually be the playoff teams. So if whether it was injury, whether it was your team's chemistry disintegrating, whatever it is, if you were the 7th or 8th seed at the end of the regular season, and you lost in this mini play-in tournament against the 9th and 10th, or the 7th through 10th tournament, then maybe you weren't fit to be in the playoffs that year. Maybe that's an indication that you weren't that good at the right time, you weren't peaking at the right time, and you actually peaked back in January, And from a competitive standpoint for the playoffs, for the quality of the playoffs, for the watchability of those early rounds, because let's face it, 1-8s and 2-7s, those series are often dreadful. But we're going to get what we think might be a really intriguing one, probably. Portland hasn't clinched it yet. But Lakers-Portland's going to be really fun. And granted, a bunch of weird stuff had to happen for that to even be the case. But I do think I understand why coaches and players might think that that a play-in tournament is going to devalue the regular season. I think I'm going to answer that with my typical, yeah, that's just tough shit. I would rather have games late March and early April be more meaningful, have a more organic way of fighting back against tanking or correcting it and giving teams incentive and keeping those fans intrigued and involved too. Instead of them rooting for lottery balls, they're rooting for them to make the 10th seed so that they can possibly knock off the 7th seed.
Okay, well, let me ask for one caveat then, because this is the other thing that I think is the problem with the play-in game. And it's a small one, but as a video coordinator, it's definitely an issue for me. The top seed doesn't know who they're going to play till the very last second. And it's not even, you know, we talk about seeding sometimes isn't set until the last day, but then you have 2 days to prepare. Well, the Lakers aren't going to know who their opponent is until Saturday at the earliest, maybe Sunday, and then they're playing on Tuesday. Everybody else has known their playoff matchups actually for a couple of days now. And I think in this scenario, it's a little bit difficult. So my caveat to you, Howard, is after the play-in games, after the seed, after it's all set up, they get to decide who do they want to play between 8 or 7.
Yeah, the choosing thing could be fun.
Like, let's have that. And then that'll add a little more intrigue in terms of, you know, the bottom seed gets to say, like, oh, they chose us. You know, they think they can beat us.
They
and
don't
all that
respect
stuff.
Us. Yeah.
Right. Because I'm just thinking of the video coordinators right now, particularly the Laker guy right now, who's putting together reports constantly, probably hasn't slept in a day or two. You know, he's worried about download speeds in the bubble right now, trying to get the files from his assistants. That's probably back in El Segundo. So I think it does, but it does hamper it a little bit. And, you know, I know people are going to come back to, you know, well, tough shit. But it's, you know, I just think it's kind of unfair. You're the number one seed. You should kind of get to know who you're going to play.
Yeah. I mean, listen, last point on this. I do think that happens in a normal season anyway, because there are times when, like, the 4-5 and the 3-6 are totally set, but the 1-2 seed are still waiting for the 7th and 8th to figure things out. And people who are in your position, video coordinators and scouts and folks, are putting together multiple reports on multiple teams, because we've had that. We've had it go down to literally the last game of the last night of the regular season to sort things out. And granted, you do have a couple of days after that before the playoffs start, so this is compressed this time in the bubble. But in a normal season, yeah, I mean, it is going to throw a little bit of a curve there. I think it's worthwhile, though. I think what the excitement we've seen the last week in particular shows the value of it. I think especially if the Suns had made it through, and it's too bad. Like it's too bad they were as bad as they were during the rest of the regular season, that their 8-0 didn't mean anything. But it just shows that a team that catches fire late, it could give them a benefit, because maybe the Suns are the best team at the end of the season, that they started off really shaky because their youth all clicked at the right time. And again, we'll get to that later when we talk about your story today. But anyway, I think there's momentum for it. I think the league office is really pleased with what they've just seen, especially with the way that the fans are excited about how many teams were involved. I think there's a really good chance that this now finally gets adopted for next season, whenever that is.
That's the other caveat.
So the other thing I feel like we could, you know, briefly touch on here. I was a very big skeptic of bringing 22 teams to the bubble. I was one who very just, callously said, screw the rest of them, cut it off at 8 in each conference, which clearly I'm now contradicting myself, because I loved all the competition we just had for the 8th seed in the West. But at the time that they were doing this, I thought you should minimize exposure, minimize the number of bodies that you have to worry about, minimize the number of people who could be bringing in the virus, all that stuff. Did the NBA's did what we've just seen the last 2 weeks vindicate the NBA's decision to bring in 22 teams, or was there still a case to be made to bring either fewer or the full 30?
I think there was a case still to be made to bring in fewer. I mean, let's just be honest. When they were discussing all of this, we really didn't understand the virus. We still don't fully know it, and it's a safety thing. At the end of the day, it's a full-on safety thing, and less bodies is safer in just general. And I think that was kind of where everybody was coming back with, like, let's just go with the 16 and things like that. Now, you have to give the NBA total credit. They've done a great job. They've kept it safe so far, knock on wood. You know, it's bringing in the 22 teams. They were able to create excitement, which, you know, there were doubts that the games were even going to be that exciting and how competitive was it going to be and who, what were the guys going to look like? Were they going to be in shape? Were they going to be conditioning? And I think, you know, the NBA got it right, but there's also a scenario in which, like, man, they gambled, yeah. You know, and it easily could have gone the wrong way pretty quickly. You know, we teams that didn't have much to play for had, you know, could have easily just laid down. And I think that's something that, you know, the NBA got away with in this scenario. So it's they succeeded. They nailed it. But I also wouldn't have been upset if they just did 16 teams.
Yeah, there was a case to be made for it. But obviously, you know, the eight teams that didn't get invited are already been out of shape about the fact that they haven't had a chance to develop their guys or keep a rhythm going or just get their guys any competition whatsoever in this long gap between the March 11th shutdown and whenever next season starts. And, you know, they've got a case. They are put at a bigger disadvantage now. And I guess if the NBA had cut it off at 16, there's, you know, that's six more teams that would have been out of shape and feeling like they did not have a chance to keep their guys in rhythm or develop young guys. I mean, I get it. The funny thing is they did invite too many teams, right? Like Washington had no business being there, and even less so once Bertans and Beal opted out. But the other team that was the last one in, the two teams, if they had done 20 and instead of 22, as they had discussed, it's Washington and Phoenix, I believe, that would have been out.
Right.
And the Suns became the feel-good story of the bubble, while the Wizards were by far the team that seemed the least relevant to the whole affair. But on balance, I'm going to say that the NBA, you know, if we're going to have the ends justify the means, like, or something, the conclusion justify the whatever, it worked out pretty well. On balance, it worked out pretty well. We had an exciting race for the eighth seed in the West. How do you feel about the Delete Eight, as John Hollinger has dubbed them? If you were working for one of those teams right now, are you feeling pretty, not just that you were irrelevant for a couple weeks here while everybody else got to play again and their fans got to get excited, and even if the team didn't make the playoffs, you know, there's, you know, think of how much better the Suns fans feel right now than they did when it started. What if the Timberwolves had gotten a chance to maybe do something similar? If you're working for one of those teams, are you pretty antsy about that? Are you demanding, as they're trying to do, as they've been talking about, another bubble for those teams? How are you feeling about this?
I mean, I feel for those teams. There's you know, they definitely missed out on an opportunity. And it's not just Phoenix, too. We're going to talk about Phoenix and dive into that. But, you know, the San Antonio young guys looked good and played hard. And, you know, there was promising stuff there. You know, there more games is more reps for development for these teams that are struggling. You know, I think we say the Delete Eight. I really want to say it's the Delete Seven, because I don't think the Warriors really want to do much right now.
Delete Eight sounds like Elite Eight. And if you knock it down to seven, you screw up John Hollinger's wonderful wordplay. And I just don't think that's fair to John Hollinger.
Well, no, but John tried to give me PTSD with a five-way tie for the play-in game as a video coordinator this week. So I'm not I'm okay if I knock down something from him.
Fair. All right.
But I just think those teams do have a case. It's hard. You know, we don't know what next season's going to look like. We don't know when it's going to begin. I mean, I saw stuff where I hit him just now, but I'll give him a little bit of love. You know, John Hollinger in his article with David Aldridge talking about next season, saying like there's a possibility he could even go to not start next season till March, and that's a full year, you know, and that's a crazy scenario, and that's difficult. So I feel for those teams. It's hard, but you know, again, I'm just going to steal your line again. It's kind of a tough shit. Like, you know, you play better when you had the chance. You can't, you know, you guys were procrastinators. You guys didn't get going till the end of the season instead of the start, and that's a tough deal there. But with the scenario we're in, a lot of people are getting screwed. So it is what it is at the end of the day.
Yeah. I mean, listen, and you know, I'm being semi-facetious with my tough shit callousness toward some of these issues, but really where I stand on this, and when I and this is what I said a couple months ago when they were first pondering how many teams to bring, and is it fair to the teams that would be cut out if they just went with the top 16 at that time? There's no fairness in a pandemic. Like, that's the thing. I don't want to hear about fairness arguments at a time when nothing is fair, right? And there are much bigger issues. So, you know, if they had cut it off at 16 and we're denied this wonderful Sun story and everything else, I would still say tough. It's like, this is not a time for anybody in the NBA to be arguing fairness when you're just trying to create an environment where you can play it all, have it be safe, have it not impact the surrounding community adversely, and just get it done and in a way that is rational and safe. So I'm just not down with a lot of the fairness arguments. On that note, you know, the grievances started flying on Twitter yesterday, as they do. Grievance Twitter is my favorite Twitter. NBA grievance Twitter. Suns fans bent out of shape because they went 8-0 and missed and said, well, then what's the point? Well, the point is that the rest of the regular season mattered too. You put yourself in too big of a hole. And look, you on balance, Suns fans, you should feel thrilled that your team suddenly looks like the youth is developing, that Devin Booker is taking another level, stepped up another level, and Ayton, you know, took off. There's hope. And, you know, if you wanted to make the eighth seed, like, I get it. It's a bummer to have it end this way. But one, there is no fairness in this situation. And two, the regular season still had to count for something, right? If the NBA wanted to make the bubble a completely, like, self-contained thing, or say the top six in each conference were locked in and we're going to let everybody try to play in for the seventh and eighth spot, like that, they could have done that, sure. But remember, this was a continuation of the season that got suspended. So that season still had to matter. So the Suns being 8-0, it would have been the same thing as if the Suns had won their last eight games in April, but after, you know, winning only, like, at a 35% clip the rest of the season. You would have finished on a really nice ending kick if they hadn't mailed it in and decided to tank for lottery balls. But that 8-0 would have been meaningless in a normal season too, potentially, because you were just too far out. So I don't buy anybody being mad about the Suns missing. I don't buy, you know, there was a Spurs fan who tweeted back at something that I put on there where he said, you know, be unfair by missing the play-in game by 0.01%. if the Spurs had won their game, because the Blazers had played three more games. And again, like, all right, well, it's just the way things broke. It's imperfect. Yeah. This is it's an imperfect season, an imperfect year, and tough. Your team wasn't good enough.
Yeah, it sucks to a degree. Going like, we went 8-0, and we're going home today. Yeah. You know, but also, there was definitely a question of whether you even should have been invited into the bubble based on your record.
Yes.
So, you know, we can go back and forth with all of this stuff. I think Suns fans enjoy this. You know, it's been a long time since you've had this kind of feeling around your team. And, you know, there's a lot of promise with this team. And I think that's kind of the thing. Like, going looking at it in the negative way, sure, you can go ahead and be that person. I'm going to look at the future because that's really what matters for them. Even making this playoffs, and this is something I'm curious about, Howard, across the board, is for teams this is their first foray into the playoffs, how much are we going to really consider it playoff experience because they haven't had to go on the road and play in the hostile environments? You know, the intensity level on the court's going to pick up. You know, we know the officiating is going to get a little bit different and things like that. But the crowds really do add another element of intensity. And I think, you know, so how much will they have really missed out on missing the playoffs? I mean, it's not like they were going to upset the Lakers. You know, it's right. You know, it's probably a sweep or a 5-game series. Go home knowing you just went on an 8-0 run and feel confident going into next season instead of getting, you know, your butts kicked in a playoff series and feeling a little bit down. So I think this is a positive thing here. I don't think they need to just relax here with the grievances.
Yes. All right, so I've teased it several times. I'm going to tease it one more time. We're going to talk a little bit more about the Suns because you have a piece about eight things we learned during the NBA's home stretch, meaning the bubble, and the Suns are on that list, and we will get to that in a minute. I want to have some fun here real quick with the ballots, with the awards, because I've hit the NBA hard on this a couple times, starting from the day that they announced we had to file ballots before the play-in or the seeding games before the resumed season. I think this was a huge mistake by the NBA. I think they misjudged it. And now that the games, the regular season games, the seeding games are over, I feel even more strongly that the NBA absolutely blew this call. We should have been able to factor in these eight seeding games because they are regular season games. They should have counted in the awards balloting. And Mo, I'm here to tell you, as somebody who has a real ballot, it would have changed at least one thing on my ballot and maybe a couple of things. And I'm gonna reveal what those are in a second here. But what did you think about the NBA's decision in the first place to basically say, well, the eight seeding games are a separate thing. They're actually going to do their bubble awards, which, you know, whatever. These are like ribbons for, you know, the kids playing youth soccer, and every game ends in a tie. It's fun. It's fine. Like, let's give the Suns a bunch of awards for playing. But these eight games, you could still do that. You could still have bubble awards. But these eight games, in my mind, they count in the standings. The statistics count. They count for posterity and historical records. They absolutely should have been factored into the awards. I still don't understand the NBA's decision here.
Yeah, I think there it was more of a precaution in case guys just didn't look right or you know, came to play and looked completely out of sorts after 4 months off. I don't know. You know, part of this is I don't know what the NBA thought they were going to get on the court in terms of, like, sure. You know, what are these guys going to look like?
Yeah.
You know, what are the games going to look like? There had to have been a fear. You know, you couldn't have been 100% sure it was going to be as competitive. You know, you had to have thought, like, oh, this could get weird real quickly and we could have problems. Yeah. And, you know, I think they wanted to try to kind of keep intact the integrity of the awards based on just everything we saw up until March. So, you know, I don't have a ballot, so I don't have to deal with the stress that you guys have to deal with and figuring out who's where and things like that. So I get to cheat and just be like, judge the list later. but I think, you know, so I don't mind it as much. But now that we've seen the way it came out, it's like, OK, well, how do we not include some of these things? And some of this stuff, you know, has changed some of your bouts. I've heard people say it would have changed some of the all NBA teams, I think, for sure.
Yeah,
I think that would have definitely had an effect.
So there were two factors, Mo, that, as I understood it, that the NBA really weighed heavily in deciding not to count the seeding games in the postseason awards balloting, to decide to have us file our ballots before it. One was, here we go again with fairness to the eight teams, to the delete eight, which I say, as people now are aware, tough shit. You weren't good enough. By the way, none of those, there's very few names on any of those teams that were going to be on of any of my awards ballots anyway, because that's what happens when you lose. You're not going to be a coach of the year candidate. You might be a rookie of the year candidate on a really bad team. You might be a most improved player, but, you know, sixth man is definitely coming from a winning team, a playoff team. All NBA choices are going to be 95% playoff teams, if not higher. There's not much it would have changed. So again, fairness, I don't care. The other one was they were worried about recency bias, about these eight games feeling too weighty because we haven't seen anything for months. Somewhat fair point to make, but I would just say this. Recency bias is okay. Hell yes, let's go recency bias. You know why? Because what you do down the stretch of a regular season matters, Mo. But yeah. Like, if Devin Booker, for instance, or Michael Porter Jr., who I'm going to get back to in a second, if they had a finishing kick like that in March and April in the final games of a normal regular season, and we file ballots when after 82 games, right? The 82nd game is done. Everything's out. And then the clock is ticking. The ballots are sent to us like a week before, but you have like 24 to 48 hours, whatever it is, after the end of the regular season in a normal year to file your ballots. And if I had just seen, let's go to Michael Porter Jr. If I had just seen him do what he did over these last eight games, and look, I'm not a big all rookies team guy. It's one of the least important awards that we vote on. But Michael Porter Jr. was not on my ballot that I filed 2 weeks ago. If these eight games had counted, he absolutely, positively would have been on. I would have bumped Eric Pascal, I should say. And now, I tweeted something about this, and my colleague Rick Bucher said, well, I had Porter Jr. on my ballot anyway. Okay, that's fine, Buke. I'm glad you saw the future. I did not. Here's what Michael Porter Jr. did in the regular season before the shutdown. Averaged 7.5 points, 4 rebounds, played 14 minutes a game, 6 field goal attempts per game. He just was not a major factor. Now, if you put him on your second team all-rookie, Buke, that's great. I'm sure some other people did, and I don't mean to make fun of it. Like, he's given how weak the all-rookie teams can be, he was as decent a candidate as anybody, I suppose. But he did not make that big of an impact. In the bubble, he averaged 22 points. That's up from 7.5. He averaged 8.5 rebounds. That was up from 4, so it doubled. 33 minutes a game, 14 field goal attempts a game, big role, looks like a future star. He's a no-brainer. And would that 8 games at the end of a normal regular season influence me? Of course it would have.
Yeah.
And I don't have any, and like, I'm not going to apologize for that. You know, the end of a regular season matters, and a finishing kick that gets your team in a better playoff position, or that, you know, allows a team like, or a player like Michael Porter Jr. to go from rehabbing fringe rotation guy to absolute staple, and given more minutes out of necessity and made the most of it and became a really important player. It's okay that the 8 games factored in more at the end of the season, because sometimes the end of the season games matter. So I'm not going to apologize for that. And I wish I had the chance to have put him on. I've got a couple. Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, no, that's fair. I mean, I think that's a fair way of looking at it. You know, I think those are the guys. I think that's where the ballot it would shift. I don't think it would have changed MVP. Maybe LeBron would have gone harder if he knew he had a chance to steal the MVP from Giannis. I think it's Giannis for the MVP. Everybody's got a different.
And Giannis was top of my ballot.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, maybe it changes things here. Maybe we look at six man a little bit differently because Montrezl Harrell didn't play at all, and Lou Williams barely played, and maybe it opens the door for Schroeder or somebody else. But I think ultimately it's the all NBA, all rookie teams, all defense teams that are going to be the ones that would have changed had we got to include the 8 games.
Yeah, so I'm going to hit a couple of these. My MVP ballot, I had Dame Lillard 5th. On my actual ballot when we filed them, right? Would I have elevated him potentially to 4th and bumped Luka to 5th after what we just saw? Maybe. It wouldn't have been any more than that. But I think there are some people who probably didn't have Dame on their ballots at all, Mo, who right. would have then made him 5th or 4th based on the last couple of weeks. So I think Dame got hurt by the ballots having been filed when they were. Most improved for me would not have changed. Defensive player of the year would not have changed. Sixth man would not have changed because all 3 of the guys on my ballot, Montrezl Harrell, Dennis Schroeder, Lou Williams, they all missed a bunch of bubble games
right.
for various reasons. So it wouldn't have changed anything there. Rookie of the year would not have changed. And in fact, Zion missing a bunch of bubble games and not playing all that well underscored why I was right to leave him off my ballot in the first place.
Right.
And the guys that I did have, Ja, Nunn, and Clark, all played meaningful games and played, you know, solidly. Coach of the year, I had Carlisle as my 3rd, and the Grizzlies could still make the playoffs, and there's a part of me that thinks maybe Taylor Jenkins instead of Carlisle, but I just think what the Mavericks did with, you know, Luke is a stud, but Porzingis was still like getting his legs back under him after all the time off from the ACL. The rest of that rotation is like really kind of nondescript. What they've right. done is absolutely amazing. So I probably would have still kept Carlisle. My all defensive teams, I don't think would have changed. All NBA is the other thing that's interesting. I had Pascal Siakam on my 2nd team at forward, and I think a lot of people did. Here was what Pascal did pre-bubble. 23.5 points a game, 7.5 rebounds, 3.5 assists, shooting splits of 46%, 36%, 80%. In the bubble, averaged 17 points, 5.7 rebounds, 2.3 assists, shooting splits of 39, 36, 71. Now, again, recency bias, is it fair? Look, if a guy down the stretch of a normal regular season started to sputter and it looked like it was possibly derailing his team because he's their most important player, would I have potentially dropped Pascal from 2nd team to 3rd team? Not off my ballot, just flip him with, you know, maybe I would have swapped him with Jason Tatum, who I had 3rd team forward. I might have flip-flopped them based on Siakam having a really lackluster last 8 games.
That's fair. I mean, I think when you look at Pascal, and I'm pulling up stats here real quick as we're talking, but it's like I felt like he was kind of sputtering a little bit before these 8 games.
Yeah.
You know, I don't feel like, you know, his numbers dipped a little bit after the All-Star break, but I've always felt like, you know, he had a really good start to the season, you know, the October, November, December, and really after that it kind of started to slow down a bit. So it's not, I think it's a fair thing. You know, I don't think it's necessarily abnormal to think like, man, no, maybe he, after these 8 games in the bubble, like, yeah, maybe he probably didn't deserve to be on my 2nd team.
Yeah. And then my last one, Ben Simmons. Ben Simmons was one of my third team guards on all NBA. Simmons and Chris Paul were my last two. And Ben Simmons ends up finishing the season having played 57 out of 72. That's the equivalent of like 65 in a normal season. And I like the cutoff for me is somewhere in like that 66 to 68 range where I really start to say, you have to have been amazing to overcome all the games missed. He missed 13 of his last 17 games going back to, you know, pre-shutdown. That matters too. If a guy misses most of the last month of a season, yeah, we often will hold that against a guy, especially when it's a competitive field and you're looking for reasons to elevate one guy over another. So availability starts to matter. And if you're not available down the stretch, also, he wasn't all that great in the three bubble games he played. So he misses, he misses five of the eight bubble games, 13 of his last 17, and played only 57 out of 72 overall for the season. I think I would have actually, I would have dropped him. I just don't know who I would have put ahead, would have replaced him with. But quite possibly Devin Booker. Now, Beal was one of my last cuts, but then Beal didn't play the bubble. So Beal only played 57 games himself, so and none in the bubble, so I probably would have had to scratch him. Devin Booker, Westbrook, Lowry, those are the other guys who were in the mix at guard for me. But I think I certainly would have dropped Ben Simmons if these games had counted for the awards, and I think it might have been Devin Booker in his place.
Yeah, I don't think Ben Simmons actually probably makes the All-NBA team if we had the normal scenario, right? And we played March and April because he was going to – we thought his season was done, you know, it, at that point. Like, or we weren't sure what was going to happen. So he would have missed, you know, the whole thing. He would have missed almost all of March, all of April. You know, I think at that point it would have opened the doors for other guys, you know, Beal not playing in the bubble, but he probably would have played in that scenario. But Lowry's deserving. Devin Booker's deserving. Westbrook was deserving. You know, the way that I love it when we're in that situation, though, because I just look at it going like the league is so healthy that when we're looking at the third team, it's not we're struggling of like, man, does anybody really deserve a third to be on the third team? It's like, no, we almost need a fourth team. Like it's so we got so much talent going on in the league. So, you know, I think that's, I think Ben Simmons is the biggest beneficiary. I hope I said the right word. benefactor of the league's decision to say, hey, we're gonna, you got to go based on the season and not the bubble, because I think that put a lot of teams, a lot of writers into saying like, okay, well, Ben Simmons should make the team just based on that. Whereas I think if it were a normal scenario, he probably wouldn't have made it.
Yeah. So you look at like, all right. So none of what I just went over, I don't know if you had any other examples that you think would have changed dramatically, but, yeah,
no, I didn't.
Okay. So, and look, I did this quick and dirty last night after the final games were over. I just kind of wanted to go through and say, okay, what, cause I hadn't thought a lot about it during the period, but those are the changes I think I would have likely made based on looking at this for a little bit last night. But I think those are enough. That's enough of a case to make that, you know what? These games should have counted. Those are reasonable changes that would have happened if the eight games had counted. And I think it just kind of underscores like these games should have counted. Certainly Michael Porter Jr., if he loses out on all rookie, again, not the biggest award in the world, but still, he could have a case for like, hey, like I should have had a chance. Devin Booker could make the case. Hey, I might've been all NBA. Right. Because again, winning matters too. Voters are influenced by winning. So when you put up great stats on a bad team, it's easier to dismiss a guy. But a finishing kick like that, even if the Suns missed the playoffs, people might have gone, you know what? The Suns were really good down the stretch. His points or his scoring, his stats did matter. They did contribute to winning. You know, he made the case for himself over the last couple of weeks of April or whatever, or the first 2 weeks of April. We would have waited in. And so I do think it would have absolutely changed. And, you know, look, I haven't polled the other 99 voters, but I got to believe some things would have changed. So your piece that went up on Bleacher Report this morning, people go check it out. It is 8 things we learned during the NBA's home stretch. There are a handful of these I really want to get into because I think they're really fascinating. Let's start with TJ Warren because he was one of the you know, fun stories of the bubble. Like, where did this guy come from? The Suns gave him away. What were they thinking at the time? All this. And he'd had a pretty solid regular season, but he was a breakout star in Orlando. What did you see from TJ Warren that was different, or should we have foreseen some of this?
I don't know how much we could have foreseen it. I mean, he was the Pacers' leading scorer going, you know, before the hiatus, but a lot of that had to do with Victor Oladipo still trying to get back in the groove, Brogdon kind of being in and out of the lineup. And when I say he was the leading scorer, it's by like half a tenth of a point or something like that. DeMontis Sabonis was right behind him. So it wasn't all that. I think the other factor that really kind of helped TJ in this scenario is also Sabonis didn't play. Like, he's getting more touches in that scenario. They were playing smaller and allowing him to get more looks and more field goal attempts and things like that. And I think that opened the door for everything. But the one thing everybody's got to remember about TJ Warren is he can flat out score. Now, I don't think anybody expected him to drop 53, right? Like, you know, we're a little bit surprised by that. But overall, like, he's a good player. He can score. He can put it in the bucket, you know, and he's got those skills. So I think in that scenario, he's able to sort of build upon that. And I think it opened things up with how the scenario played out for the Pacers. And the big thing I liked about it, Howard, most importantly, was it led to wins.
Yeah.
It wasn't just like I'm scoring because I can score and somebody's got to take these shots. He was doing it in rhythm of the offense and in the flow. And it opened things up for Coach McMillan. Like, he knows if we can go smaller, I can still have scoring on the court, you know, and I could maybe put Sabonis on the bench for next season for a little bit for a lineup and have, you know, three guards on the court and really attack and put up points. And I think that's the kind of thing going forward to keep an eye on. And it's something that I don't know if he'll continue to score at this high of a clip, but we do know that he can get hot. And that's something that teams are going to have to account for whenever they scout.
Yeah. The only thing I wondered about, you know, in terms of sustainability was just, you know, his 3-point shooting efficiency went way up. And anybody can have, not anybody, but guys will sometimes have an 8-game hot streak, a month hot streak. And actually the analytics guys will tell you even a season of, if you were a, you know, career 32% 3-point shooter and suddenly you have a season where it's 38, they're still going to say, wait for one more season. Don't say that this guy suddenly has a 3-point stroke and now he's like a really good solid 3-point shooter. Like, even a single season is not statistically significant enough for most guys, unless, you know, something serious changed in with them physically or their shot itself. But a single season is often kind of dismissed or at least caution flags. So 8 games of really hot 3-point shooting, you know, I don't know how much stock we should put in. The flip side of TJ Warren would be another guy who made your column, Lonzo Ball. Did not shoot well, that's putting it kindly. And there was a story in The Athletic this morning in which David Aldridge noted that some people thought that Lonzo seemed a little checked out. My cat is now making a guest appearance on Zoom here, which the listeners cannot see. That he seemed maybe a little bit checked out or maybe at least not fully engaged, and that's led to some prompting of speculation about his future with the franchise. Now, Lonzo Ball looked really good at times in the regular season before the shutdown. And now you've got Drew Holiday, who's a veteran, who's you know, older, so he's not necessarily, you know, Drew's not on the same timeline as your young guys, Zion and Ingram, these guys. But, you know, you could have both, but if maybe you're starting to wane in your belief in Lonzo and you're about to have to give a massive contract to Ingram, I don't know. What'd you see from Lonzo?
Yeah, it was pretty surprising to see. I'm not so much surprised he struggled with the scoring, because I think that tends to happen a little bit up and down. But I didn't feel like he even brought the defensive intensity either, you know, that we normally kind of thought, like, okay, well, at least he can defend, you know. And let's be honest, the biggest thing when it comes to Lonzo since he's entered the league is, you know, he's got that funky form on his shot, and it's improved this year. And you got to give a shout out to Fred Vinson for on the staff for the Pelicans, who's really worked with him, and you know, they've done a much better job of it. But it goes back to what you were saying with the analytics guys. Let's wait a year. You know, this is the one year where he looked, his shooting was much improved, and we felt confident about it. But we had to see if it's a fluke or whatnot. And it kind of is scary for anybody, especially for the Pelicans, seeing how poorly he shot, you know, in the bubble, in that scenario. And, you know, this is one of those things I think they really have to look deep into and decide what they want to do, because like you said, Ingram's contract's coming up. After that, they got to decide on an extension or not for Lonzo, and then they got to figure out how they want to play things with Jrue Holiday. And, you know, the stuff that David Aldridge is alluding to, you know, something you got to figure out right away. Does the guy even really want to be here? What's the story here? Because if he's coming in and not into it and locked in, then he's not going to be a piece for you in the future, and he's not going to be a guy you're going to invest big money in when his extension comes. So, you know, they got a lot of questions they got to figure out. It's a tough one to fully invest in. So, you know, I know all of these are tough because it's an 8-game sample size, but we got to look at it because I think it matters.
And look, you know, Lonzo and Jrue can play together, but I think having Jrue, you know, Drew's 30 and he's had some injury issues, but if you're pretty confident in his health, and his longevity, and Jrue is like just a phenomenal player, perennially underrated, perennially overlooked for awards, all NBA, all defense, all, you know, all-star, everything. You don't need Lonzo. And I understand like the desire to have guys on the same timeline, but it's also nice to have actually your young growing stars like Ingram and Zion have a rock of a veteran, especially at a position like point guard. So you can play Jrue and Lonzo together, but you also don't have to, and you don't have to have Lonzo. Like you can just say, you know what, flip him to a team that needs a young point guard that still believes in him, that thinks the best is yet to come, and probably the best is still yet to come for him. No, you know, I think that's likely. But the Pelicans don't have to wait on him.
He's the one guy they don't have to wait on, right? Like the most important building blocks for this team are really Zion Williamson and Brandon Ingram. Everything else after that is how do we build around, how do these guys fit around these two players, you know? And I think Lonzo fits really well with Zion. You know, when they're on the court, he finds Zion the most. He makes the most, you know, lob passes, the kick aheads and things like that. Like there's a value there.
Yes.
But that only works if Lonzo's locked in. And that's a key thing that they have to figure out and explore. And that's the big question mark there. If he's locked in, then they're in good shape. If he's not, then it's just, what's the point?
We've teased the Suns fans too many times in this podcast. I'm now in minute 48. We've already gone the full 48. We're in overtime. The Suns. Wow, the Suns. I don't even know where to begin because we focus so much on Devin Booker, in part because of that amazing shot against the Clippers, in part because of his sheer numbers and production and the fact that it led to an 8-0 record. But there were so many other pieces that came into play here, like Cameron Payne.
Yeah,
I didn't know Cameron Payne still existed. Cameron Payne, Mikal Bridges, Ayton. There's so many directions you could go here. Is there any one thing or couple of factors that you thought were the standout reasons why the Suns went 8-0 in the bubble?
I'll hit a couple of them real quickly. I think Mikal Bridges making a leap on the offensive end helps to keep him on the floor because he's such a good defender. Mm. You know, and you know, he was shooting the ball much better. And again, it's a short sample size, all that. But, you know, it's stuff that you can look at going like, this is something we can be excited about. Cam Johnson is everything they thought they were going to get from Josh Jackson. And they got killed for drafting Cam as early as they did.
Yes.
And you know what? It paid off for them. And, you know, everybody's going to kill them for trading T.J. Warren. That's fine. But T.J. Warren probably wouldn't have the year he's having in Phoenix. And Phoenix probably wouldn't have the year they're having now with T.J. Warren, and Cam Johnson's part of that. DeAndre Ayton's improvement defensively has been great from his rookie year to this year, and you're seeing it continue throughout all this. And the one thing, and this one's subtle, and this was kind of a product of the bubble, but, you know, when Aaron Baines opted out, you know, it forced Monty Williams to kind of have to figure out what to do in the backup center position. And I love what he did. He just put Saric there. And Saric showed, like, hey, I can be a playmaking big man, you know, and create for others. And it kind of unlocked Saric to a degree. You know, we're beginning to see the guy that he was in Turkey kind of open up here a little bit. So, like, all of those factors come into it, which to me, at the end of the day, comes down to coaching. And I think Monty Williams has done a phenomenal job in terms of building a culture, changing the culture there, and building it up. And it's something that, you know, we're going to expect a lot from the Suns next year. And, you know, I want to caution people here, and I want to caution Suns fans in particular. I'm speaking directly to you guys, okay? Don't panic next year because the West is so stacked.
Yeah.
Whatever next year looks like, the West is so stacked. There's going to be 3 or 4 good teams that are not going to make the playoffs next year in the West. And that's just a scenario, and it might be the Suns, it might not be. but they're going to be in the mix. And that's something that the Phoenix Suns fans have not been able to be excited about over the past few years. And right now, I think we're beginning to see the turn here.
Yeah. And a huge credit to Monty Williams and his staff too. Just like, that's a lot of youth to develop, and some reclamation projects in there too, and guys that you just weren't sure how they fit. And yeah, they got killed for the trade that it was a draft day trade to get Cam Johnson, right?
Yeah. Well, it was to open up cap space so that they could bring in Ricky Rubio, who's also right. played an important piece, and they got Cam Johnson in that deal.
Right. Okay. So all these things were interrelated. Yeah. You know, look, the only thing you could say about the TJ Warren thing, like you know, could you have gotten a better return for him? Yes, you could still criticize them for that. But in terms of like the cap room that it opened up and the minutes that it opened up and everything else, like, so, yeah, it worked out for them. You know, if this group going forward continues to develop like this, and especially if they do, you know, crack the playoffs next year, then people can forget about, you know, any TJ Warren, you know,
right.
Misgivings, right? Like, it's not going to be a backbreaker. It's not going to be like, you know, the Nets mortgaging their future for, you know, Pierce and Garnett. It's not that kind of scale. So give this newish front office, I think, a little bit of latitude probably. And by the way, yeah, the Western Conference next year is insane. I mean, I know it's like stupidly early to be looking ahead, but the Lakers are still going to have LeBron and AD most likely. The Clippers are still going to have Paul George and Kawhi. The Nuggets now have Michael Porter Jr. blossoming next to Jokic, so they're not going anywhere. The Thunder could fall out depending on what they do and all the, you know, there's Chris Paul speculation and everything. Right. Like, the Thunder may finally decide, let's cash out and see what else we can do and really truly start the rebuild. So they're potentially in play. The Rockets are weird, but they're probably still in the playoffs as long as Harden is there, and Harden and Westbrook probably together still. But, you know, they'll have other changes this offseason, I think, maybe. The Jazz aren't going anywhere. The Mavericks are only getting better. The Blazers shouldn't have been as low as they were in the first place, and none of their core guys are going anywhere. The Grizzlies clearly are a team on the rise, and despite injuries to Jaren Jackson Jr. and Justice Winslow, like, those guys will be back. So the Suns, right. we mentioned. The Spurs will probably continue to do their slow fade. The Kings will be weird because they're the Kings. But the Pelicans, I mean, the Pelicans are a team that I thought if the season had kept going in March, I thought were coming for the eighth seed. I thought that was the right. last team in. And so I think the Pelicans are going to be in there. So you've got, I think, 10, 11 teams.
But Howard, you're also forgetting one team.
Oh, yeah, that one at the bottom that I haven't gotten to yet. I'm working my way down the standings, Mo, all right? Pelicans,
sorry,
Timberwolves.
I got too excited.
And then... then the Warriors. I'm gonna throw out the Thunder for the sake of argument. So seven of the eight of nine with the Grizzlies, nine of ten with the Suns, 12. I think I've got 12 teams vying for eight spots, counting the Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, Andrew Wiggins Warriors.
Yeah, I mean, it's just stacked. So it's going to be a crazy it's going to be one of those things next year where there's just going to be good teams that aren't going to make the playoffs. And that's just something we're going to. So don't freak out if you're a young team that doesn't make the playoffs, because let's remember one thing, too. Devin Booker's not even 25 yet. Wow. I don't even think he's 24.
Yeah, I'll have to look that one up while we're talking. this brings me to my other radical, you know, commissioner for a day drunk with power kind of move here, which is, if you've got like multiple teams in the West that are going to be like 45 wins and up, and a bunch of crap in the East going on, you toss out the 6th, 7th, 8th seeds in the East, and you move the West teams over there just temporarily for the sake of not a 1 through 16 purely. Just if there are crappy teams making the playoffs in one conference, usually the East. You can't. You're done. You're tossed. Like the Magic and the Nets this season, you're out. Put the Suns in instead.
Yeah, I'm with you. Although I'll say this, Washington's going to be fun next year, so that's going to be one team that'll be better.
I'm not entirely sold. We'll save that one for another podcast, because I do want to get to one of your last items on your 8 Things We Learned piece. Vulnerable Lakers. They've not been great in the bubble, but like, they didn't have a lot to play for in the bubble either. Like, LeBron had to manufacture this idea that we got to lock down the one seed because people said it couldn't be done or something. But they haven't looked great. Their offense, I think, is second to last among the bubble teams. Their backcourt is thin, Rondo may be coming back soon, but I'm not sure how big of a help that is. And then if it is the Blazers they're going against, you've got one of the best backcourts in the NBA, and Lillard's just absolutely on fire. Now, I don't know that the Blazers can contend with LeBron and AD at the other end, so it may not matter. But, I mean, the Lakers are maybe the least suited to dealing with a Lillard-McCollum backcourt.
Yeah, it's scary in that sense. Even if they – I mean, Ja Morant's going to cause a problem for them if it's Memphis that happens to make the run. You know, they, just the small scoring guards are going to be an issue for the Lakers the way it's set up. And that's where they miss Avery Bradley and all of that. But the stuff that's scary to me is just they look out of sync. You know, it's we've seen it before. We've seen Danny Green go through cold streaks. Like, this is the San Antonio experience with Danny Green. He gets really hot and he gets really cold, and you got to try to snap him out of it. And I think KCP is shooting below 30% as well, and I think that's another guy they need to try to get going. It's just scary that it's how out of sync they looked. It's not even that I don't expect them to look great. I didn't expect them to kind of be playing with crazy effort or anything like that. But I didn't expect them to look this off. You know, timing was off. The flow was off all the way to their last game. So, you know, I kind of think they might benefit, Howard, from a tough first-round series. And we've seen teams struggle in a first-round series and go on to win championships. You know, San Antonio's last championship, the Dallas Mavs pushed them to 7 in the first round. The Boston Celtics were pushed by Atlanta to 7 games in the first round. I think sometimes you need that kind of, like, it's almost a slap in the face of like, yo, wake up, guys, we got to go now. So I think they kind of almost need that a little bit. So, and you know, LeBron plays better when he has a manufactured narrative here, and this can help him, because there are a lot of people out there saying, oh, the Blazers can give him a real run or things like that.
Yeah, that'll
I have questions
off.
About that. Yeah, you know, but that's enough to get – that gets him motivated. That's a win.
Where are you on Kuzma? Because he makes a game-winning shot, and now everybody's celebrating him again. He's a guy who I feel like every year people look for reasons, Laker fans especially, and you're out there in L.A., people are always looking for reasons to elevate Kuzma to, you know, a superstar and skip right past All-Star and everything else. He's a good, solid player. I don't know that he's ever been exactly what he's been hyped to be. But he had a good run here these last couple of weeks. Where are you on Kuzma? And, you know, listen, I hadn't heard the Lakers verbalize this the same way that we in the media had about who's their third guy. Because, like, we look at the Clippers and we say, you know, you've got Lou Williams. You've got other guys who can do something. The Lakers don't have that definite. LeBron himself now said it. Hey, if me or AD are off, you know, Kuz is the guy who's got to do it. Can he be that guy? Is he that guy right now? How much of a difference in his play have you seen the last 2 weeks?
So I've never been a massive Kuzma guy. Like, you know, you said it out here in LA, the hype is unbelievable. You know, him and Caruso, they do one thing positive, you know, they pick up litter. Everybody's going completely nuts. You know, it's one of those things, but I think his ceiling is a high level role player. I don't know if he's ever going to truly be a third guy, but he's shown great flashes in this bubble that has had me excited about him right now. And the way I look at it, one, he's shooting a very high percentage from three, 44%, which, look, law of averages, probably going to go down a little bit. But if he's shooting 38% from three, that's consistently, that's a big win for the Lakers and to help spread the floor. But the thing that has me most excited about him right now, Howard, is that he's actually defending and he's trying on defense. The effort there defensively has been phenomenal. He's gotten beat a few times. He's not maybe made the right rotations here and there, but he's trying. Whereas I've seen a lot of him where he doesn't. And it's just, you know, guys run right by him and he's just, you know, looking confused. He made a lot of efforts. He switched on to Paul George late in those games, in the first game in the bubble, and was coming up with some pretty good stops and had a big steal at the end of the game. So I think all of that stuff kind of is giving me promise here. I think we're seeing him mature a little bit. I don't know if he's ever going to reach the crazy status that the Laker fans are hoping, but if he ends up being a high-level role player for this team, that's a win for a guy that they got late in the draft. And I think that's something that you got to feel positive about going into the playoffs. He's been the one bright spot for the Lakers, I think, in the bubble so far.
Yeah. For those of us who sometimes allow ourselves to become prisoners of the moment because it's fun, and are always rooting for some bit of intrigue, as we do in my profession. The idea of the Blazers being, as Chris Mannix said on this podcast last week, the best eighth seed in the history of mankind, or something to that effect, at a time when the Lakers look a little shaky, like gives us this thought, oh, well, maybe not necessarily an upset brewing, but look, we don't get many great 1-8 matchups in this league. The NBA, there's very little suspense in the first round, especially with the 1-8 and 2-7s. They're often very, you know, they're dreadful series usually. So the thought of the Lakers being pushed hard and Lillard going for 50 a couple of times and pushing them to 6 games, maybe a 7th game, no home court advantage for the Lakers, all these things, like, it's fun to think about. Are we getting carried away?
I think a little bit. And the one thing I want to say is, man, they got to be exhausted. The Blazers, every game they've had to play in the bubble, they've not had a night off. You know, some of the games that Memphis has had, other teams have sat their stars. I mean, Giannis didn't play in their last game against Memphis. And they were able to kind of chill and skate through some wins. Every game for the Blazers has been a brutal affair. And Dame's been playing 40-something minutes. You have Nurkic still coming back from a year-long injury, and conditioning takes a while to really build all of that up. And then just the emotional and mental fatigue, right? You come off after all of this, and let's assume they win the play-in game on Sunday. You know, they get one day off, and that's prep day. That's the day they're prepping for the Lakers, so it's not a full day off. You know, they're probably going to do a bunch of film and walk through stuff. And then they're playing on Tuesday. Like, that's just, there's just no energy. I mean, it's just hard to manufacture that. And maybe they have a great game one, but you can see it fade. And watch carefully, you know, when they miss their shots, if they're missing it short, because that's usually legs. That's usually their legs beginning to go. And you can kind of see it happening almost in real time as you watch these games. So I think, you know, we're getting a little bit carried away. And as somebody who was on a 1 seed that got upset by the 8 seed, when I was in San Antonio and Memphis beat us, you know, like, I know I have the experience. I just don't know if the Portland Trailblazers have enough gas to really get all the way to the end.
Yeah. And obviously CJ McCollum isn't completely physically there now, or whatever I can't remember what they're calling the injury in his back. I don't want to misquote it, but so there are some concerns there clearly. And look, if Portland can beat Memphis, Portland has the advantage now of being the for the moment, 8th seed. And so they only have to win once. So if Portland can beat Memphis on Saturday, they get Sunday off at least before the playoffs start. I can't remember if the Lakers were on the docket for Monday or not. I got to
look. No, it's a Tuesday. There is Tuesday.
All right, so now they buy themselves a two-day break.
Right.
But if they lose Saturday and have to beat the Grizzlies on Sunday, and then, you know, yeah, now they're really going to be gassed. So it's a great point. And they've been a fun story. But yeah, probably things go back to form where the 1 seed is as dominant as you expect them to be. The Lakers snap to form and the Blazers go. I don't know. I'm still going to let myself believe that we could have this really fun just shootout for, you know, whatever, 6 games at least.
Well, that's the only way. That's what Portland's got to turn it into.
Yeah.
It's got to just be a straight shootout. And Dame's got to be a flamethrower. And I mean, Howard, he pulled up from half court.
That was just ridiculous. That was stupid.
I mean, it got to the point where I was like, I'm not going to be surprised if he pulls up behind half court. Like, yeah. I have no, it was just, you know, so he's going to have to be phenomenal for another stretch. And God, man, like, it would be impressive, and it'd be amazing. And I have a friend who's a diehard Portland fan who's going to yell at me for not saying they have a chance to win it all, to win the series. But he's going to have to take it to even another notch to really upset the Lakers.
I don't know what that notch is. I guess it is now pulling up from before midcourt and scoring 70 points instead of 60. Before I let you go, do you have any quick thoughts on the Bulls firing Jim Boylan this morning? The timing was weird. The Bulls were not, you know, have not been a participant in anything for months, and Arturas and his crew have been in charge for months already. It was strange that they waited until August 14th to pull the trigger on something that people thought, you know, the case was already there to be made a long time ago. So any quick hit thoughts on that before I let you go?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it's the right decision. I'm not a big Coach Boylan fan. I think he had issues. You saw it on Zach LaVine's face. Every time he'd call a timeout, he'd roll his eyes or something like that. That's never a good thing. The timing-wise, you know, I'm not as off put as everybody else about it, just because I feel like he really put his time into making sure this is the right decision, you know. And also, people have to realize when you fire a coach, you have to figure out who you're going to replace him with. Who are the candidates that are available? And the good thing for them is nobody else has really made a move except for the Knicks, and they hired Tom Thibodeau. I don't think that was the guy they were going to bring back to Chicago. So it's no. not like they've lost a candidate in that run, you know. And, you know, there's going to be a lot of names that they could look at, and they can take their time here in terms of really investing and interviewing guys and all of that. And it's a weird situation because are you going to interview guys through Zoom or Skype? Like, and are you going to hire them that way? Like, you know, you want to have at least a face-to-face at some point, but with the way things are now, I don't know if you can.
Well, so the Knicks did it, you know. It can be done.
Yeah, it was a long-standing relationship, though, that I think we've kind of felt like this was...
My point being they did interview, like, whatever, a dozen other coaches.
Yeah.
So, you know, it can be done. I thought the timing was weird. I'm not criticizing the timing. It's just more of like, why today? Why now? Sometimes it's, you know, somebody becomes available and you want to jump on that guy, but none of the teams that just lost in the bubble have fired their coaches yet. So you're not, I don't know. If they were waiting on a guy, it doesn't feel like anything that just happened would change that. I think Casey Johnson reported that Ime Udoka was on their list. And if that's the case, okay, well, you know, now is he available now? I mean,
it's open, you know. I think it's just, you know, you want to give yourself the time to be able to put that whole list together, because you are right. The Knicks did interview a bunch of guys and really kind of gave themselves a view of everybody that's out there and then made their decision. I think this allows them, the Bulls, to do the same thing. And I just don't think there's a why today. It's something that I think we could have asked at any point, you know, if they fired him next week, you know, right? So it's like, I just think for them, it's just like, hey, let's pull the trigger and let's just start the process of let's start bringing in guys and start deciding who we want to figure out who's going to take control of this team.
I was thinking Udoka was still with the Spurs. Of course, he's with the Sixers now, so he is still active. So he is another guy on their list that is still working. So I don't know. I don't know what's moving them to do it today specifically. But anyway, Bulls fans are rejoicing, and it'll be interesting to see who they bring in. Mo, this has been great, man. Good to get you back on. Your hair looks great. Nice job with the self cuts there, the self grooming. I'm not that adventurous yet. My hair is on 5 months and counting. I have to wear a hat all the time. It's just a moppy mess. It's crazy. My wife and daughter are starting to question my sanity, or maybe at a higher degree than they were before. I don't know what I'm going to do, but looking good. Great stuff. Appreciate you spending the time.
Oh, no, thank you so much for having me, man. I'm a big fan of the show, so this is kind of a big moment for me. So anytime I get to come on and talk hoops with you, I'm always going to be happy.
I appreciate that, man. Too kind of you. Again, check out Mo's stuff on Bleacher Report, his story this morning, 8 Things We Learned During the NBA's Home Stretch. Of course, he is also on the podcast Stylings from The Athletic. Find him there. Thanks, man. We'll talk to you soon.
Sounds good.